and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. I'm Jess Peake, Assistant Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights, and in this episode, I will be talking to Dr. Sorka McLeod. Dr. McLeod is an Associate Professor and Marie Curie Individual Fellow at the University of Copenhagen Faculty of Law in the Center for Private Governance. Dr. McLeod is an internationally recognized expert on business and human rights and security, in particular, the regulation and human rights impacts of private military and security companies. In 2018, Dr. McLeod was appointed as an independent human rights expert to the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries, established under the Human Rights Council's special procedures. And she's also an invited expert to the UN Open-Ended Intergovernmental Working Group on Private Military and Security Companies, and participated in the drafting of the Montreux Document on Private Military and Security Companies and the International Code of Conduct for Private Security Providers. Dr. McLeod has observer status at the International Code of Conduct Association and advises governments, civil society organizations, and industry on human rights. So welcome, Sorka.
Thank you, Jess. It's lovely to be here.
So today we're going to be talking about some of the work you've been doing recently on private security, human rights, and COVID-19. So I wondered if you could start us off with sort of providing some of the context to that. I think many of us, when we think about private security, think of them as being used in a conflict situation. And here you're talking about private security being used by states as they're seeking to manage COVID-19. So can you explain sort of how and why these groups are being used in this context?
Absolutely. I should say, first of all, that I'm speaking in my personal academic capacity today. So I'm not speaking on behalf of the working group on the use of mercenaries, although I may well refer to some of our work as we go through, if it's relevant. So I've been thinking, as many people have, about how COVID-19 and the pandemic in general is impacting on human rights. And particularly, of course, in the area that I'm interested in, which is private security. And I think we've been seeing certain patterns emerging. So one of the patterns that we're seeing is that many more states are turning to private security, and states that were already using private security are increasing their use of private security during the COVID-19 pandemic. And they are using them for all of the sort of traditional purposes that they have done in the past. So, you know, in some countries you have private security providing security for prisons, private prisons, detention centers, migrant detention centers, border control. That's been happening for a long time, and that shift to new spaces by private security actors has been occurring over a number of years now. But what we're seeing with the pandemic is that the private security sector is repositioning itself. Now, for some time, particularly in armed conflict situations, they have sought to reposition themselves as humanitarian actors. That's not new. So you see them positioning themselves as a humanitarian actor by supporting NGOs or, you know, food convoys, that sort of thing, in terms of the guarding activities that they're carrying out. So that sort of humanitarian side of the industry is not something new. But what is new is them shifting into humanitarian activities outside of conflict zones and outside of post-conflict zones into peacetime settings. And that's what's happening during the pandemic. So we're starting to see lots of examples of private security personnel taking medical histories, for example, medical testing sites. They are taking temperatures. They are gathering sometimes biometric data from individuals. So they are operating in this new space, and it raises questions about regulation. It raises questions about human rights, particularly in relation to privacy. But it's something that is very problematic, because the other thing that's going on with this increase the use of private security is the reduction in public procurement processes. In many countries around the world, the private security sector has been designated as essential. And what that means is because there is a public emergency, we're seeing emergency regulations being put in place where the normal channels of public procurement, the normal oversight and checks and balances of public procurement are not in fact being utilised. So you've got increased use, you've got broader use, you've got new spaces, you've got emergency legislation and stepping back from traditional regulatory mechanisms, and it sort of all coalesces around the pandemic. We've seen, you know, public security being cut back as, you know, we see this, you know, the so-called retreat of the state. Now, for some countries have made a very specific decision to do that and to turn to the private sector to take over public activities. You know, so as I said at the beginning, we're seeing the countries that were already using outsourcing are increasing their use of outsourcing, and then the countries that maybe weren't doing so much have found themselves in the midst of a global pandemic that they simply don't have the capacity to deal with the issues that they're facing.
You mentioned there, Sokka, that COVID-19 has led to an increase in the use of sort of emergency legislation to cope with these public health crises. Could you say a little bit about why emergency legislation is sort of being utilized in this current moment and how states are relying on a situation of public emergency to do that?
So even, you know, I'm based in Denmark, and you know, even Denmark has turned to emergency legislation to authorize the use of force and also detention by private security providers as a means of supporting the public health response to the pandemic. And that was under the Danish Epidemic Act. So, you know, most countries, you know, they do have emergency legislation, and states are turning to that emergency legislation to authorize the use of private security in these different situations that are coming out or arising from COVID-19.
And what human rights implications does the retreat of the state, as you termed it, sort of have? You mentioned privacy earlier, but is that the only right that we're concerned with, or are there sort of more broader rights that are implicated here?
There are absolutely broader issues. There are some really serious human rights issues at stake. So one of the things that I'm particularly focused on in my research is how private security specifically impacts marginalized groups and groups that could be described as vulnerable or have a tendency to be vulnerable. So migrant groups, racialized persons, the LGBT plus community, persons with disabilities, persons living in poverty, homeless persons, they are all particularly vulnerable to being on the receiving end of human rights violations in a whole variety of different ways. If you look at migrants, for example, as I said earlier, we've got a lot of private security providers being used around the immigration and border spaces, and that's something that it's been a, you know, a long-standing human rights concern. It's particularly relevant in, I think, in two different places. One is in detention facilities. So if you've got migrants who are being detained or incarcerated in privatized security facilities, so they're in a migrant detention center, for example, or an asylum center or a deportation facility, but also at the border itself. But let's talk about detention first of all, because people who are in the migrants who are detained in these facilities are rendered even more vulnerable than they potentially already are. With the working group, and I said I'd talk about the working group where it was relevant, the working group on mercenaries, we have been involved in allegation letters specifically to the United States, but also to Australia in relation to privatized security facilities, and specifically in relation to migrants. We've had received reports of overcrowding, unsanitary conditions. So of course, in the middle of a pandemic, then you know that's the worst, you know, the worst place to be, because you've got no possibility for social distancing, you've got no possibility of self-isolation. And you know, we continue to receive information and allegations that people are being denied access to adequate healthcare, they're being denied access to adequate food, for example. And then if you start taking an intersectional lens to this, if you start looking at migrants who have disabilities or who have underlying health conditions, then they are potentially particularly at risk. And my colleagues in other special procedures have written about this. So the Rapporteur on Health, the Rapporteur on Persons with Disabilities, they've highlighted the fact that persons with disabilities, persons with underlying health conditions are, of course, much more susceptible to contracting COVID-19. Mm-hmm. If you put them in, if you've then got these people who are additionally migrants in the overcrowded and unsanitary conditions, it can have a real knock-on effect. I mean, one example, that the Rapporteur on Sexual Orientation and Gender identified is in relation to persons who are HIV positive. Mm-hmm. So if you have a migrant who is a gay man or who is a trans woman and who are HIV positive, which tends to be a significant proportion of the HIV community. If they are then, again, you know, they have compromised immune systems, they're in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions, the risk of them contracting COVID or other health issues associated with that detention, you know, really, really rises significantly. So when you have these intersections of migrant status, disability, health conditions, sexuality, gender, you then really can see how people can be rendered extremely vulnerable in those sorts of situations.
And so how, if at all, are private security companies being regulated in these spaces, and what more should be done to ensure that these particularly vulnerable communities are having their rights protected?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, there is a lot of soft law out there, and there's a lot of international soft law. And by that, I mean, it's non-binding. So in the sort of aftermath of the military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, we saw the international community moving towards wanting to regulate the so-called private military and security companies. And that has happened. And that has been a positive thing. But at the same time, we have not seen states at the domestic level necessarily regulating these companies at the same time. But if we talk about the international regulatory framework, there are two that are relevant. One is the Montreux document, which is specifically aimed at the use of private military security companies in situations of armed conflict. Which we're really not talking about here, but just for the sake of completeness, that's a document that tries to encourage states to regulate these types of companies at the national level. Mm-hmm. What's more relevant here, I think, is the International Code of Conduct for Private Security Providers. And that's a code that's been around for 10 years now, and its aim is twofold. It's really to try and ensure compliance with human rights standards by what are described as private security providers. The military element is taken out of the definition. and to ensure good corporate governance. Mm-hmm. Again, it was this response to the poor regulation of these actors in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the problems with the code is its scope, its geographical scope. It only applies to what are called complex environments. And complex environments are really only to be considered as situations of armed conflict, post-conflict situations, and situations where the rule of law has been severely damaged as a consequence of a humanitarian or environmental disaster. So if you try and put the sorts of situations that we're seeing with COVID-19, particularly in Europe and the United States, I think particularly, they don't necessarily fit into this definition of a complex environment. Now, the code tries to ensure that these companies do in fact comply with human rights standards. But the focus is quite narrow in terms of human rights. I mean, they're supposed to comply with all human rights standards. You know, we could look to the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, as a source there. But if you look at the code, it talks about not violating the right to life, not violating the right to be free from torture, talks about forced labor, human trafficking, harassment, discrimination, detention. It's relatively narrow in its scope, and it tends to focus the company's attention on just those rights rather than issues like the right to health or the right to access healthcare or food. Those sorts of more complex human rights violations don't really get much attention, if any, actually in the code. So that's also a problem. And the reality is the security sector is a very broad sector, and it's really helpful to think about it as a spectrum. So you do have the companies that are operating in situations of armed conflict, where they are guarding embassies or they're guarding NGO personnel or convoys, as we already mentioned this earlier. But you've got the whole spectrum of companies that are not operating in armed conflict situations. You know, you might be talking about a security guard in South Africa who's guarding somebody's property. And the reality is that actually in a COVID-19 situation, you're actually seeing those guards being put at risk. And this has actually been one of the big challenges. It's not just about the people that they're guarding in, say, a detention centre. But I mean, in the UK, the Office of National Statistics showed that the occupation of security guard was one of the most dangerous when it came to contracting COVID-19. So you've also got labour rights, as a human rights element, raising its head as well.
You mentioned the Montreux document and the code of conduct, which I understand are, you know, two of the main regulatory documents that we have. But if we look at kind of the state parties to those or signatories to those, we're talking about very few states, yes. Right? And so practically speaking, how can we encourage more states to follow these types of standards in regulating private security companies domestically?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's not only that there's not many states being involved, it's also that this is, as I said at the beginning, is soft regulation, so it's not binding on them. The way that the code envisages ensuring human rights compliance is through auditing and certification. That's what's envisaged by the code, that companies essentially pay for a certification body to come and carry out an audit against a specific human rights standard for private security companies. And when they get that certificate, they basically go to the International Code of Conduct Association and say, we got our certificate, you know, will you certify us as being in compliance with the code? And the ICOCA, the International Code of Conduct Association, will ask for some additional information and say, and then grant the certification or not, and does actually engage in, it can also receive complaints. So you can actually make a complaint against a member company of the Code of Conduct Association. Ultimately, that company could be kicked out of the association, which is actually quite a powerful tool, because we are seeing, you know, some countries. So the United States, for example, requires its contractors to have that certification. And other countries are sort of following along that route. Not many, but it's an interesting way to do it. One of the things we've done with the UN Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries is we've worked with the security division of the UN. And so the UN security now, in certain circumstances, requires its contractors, security contractors, to be certified and to be members of the International Code of Conduct Association. So it's very much, it's not the, you know, it's not the stick approach, it's not the legal stick approach to compliance, it's very much the carrot approach to compliance. And I suppose it fits very much within the broader approach of business and human rights, you know, using norm internalization and norm socialization to change company culture and to change the sector. Having, you know, it's not of itself a bad thing. If it's done well, it does definitely have potential. But I would always say that we need to look to states to regulate this industry, both at the national and at the international level. The reality is that the soft law approach simply isn't enough. And when we're talking about COVID-19, it's not necessarily going to help us hold companies to account for human rights violations because of the limitations of the scope, because of this requirement that it only applies to complex environments. So if we're talking about a detention center and a migrant detention center in a country, it's not necessarily going to be regarded as a complex environment. Therefore, the code doesn't apply. Therefore, you have to look to domestic legislation. And one of the big concerns about COVID-19 is that the use of these emergency powers becomes concretized, and it becomes the norm. And that's a really dangerous position for human rights to be. Mm-hmm.
So, Soka, you talk a lot in your work about gender and the role that gender plays. So could you just help us think about how we can center gender in thinking about the actions of private security companies and how to regulate them?
I mean, this is something where my work, my own research, and the work of the Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries really, really intersects. And we actually, as a working group, published a report last year on the gendered human rights impacts of private military and security companies. And I would urge everyone to read it if they haven't done so already. You can find it on our website. I mean, it's a huge topic. I mean, the reality is you're talking about an industry that is highly masculinized. A lot of the people who are working in the industry have come out of the military, or they come out of the security services, the armed forces, the police, or whatever it happens to be. And a lot of the kinds of structures, the sort of very masculinized structures that exist in those areas, then become, you know, they're transported into the private sector. And so gender's not really considered. Let me give you an example. The impacts, the human rights impacts, are not really considered, and they might be different. That if you've got a private security guard, if we talk about it in the COVID-19 context, which wasn't something that we talked about in our report, but if you think about it in the COVID-19 context, if you've got a security guard who is at a testing center, who is taking personal medical information, and you have a male security guard and a female person who wants to get tested. What training has this security guard had to take that kind of personal medical information? What's going to happen to that information? Who's going to use it? And we've already been hearing anecdotally that that sometimes that information is being misused in a gendered fashion. So it's being used to contact a woman afterwards, to try and initiate some sort of relationship with her. Mm. And you can imagine, perhaps if you're a woman who's menstruating or you're pregnant, you might not want to be sharing those sorts of issues, those sorts of personal medical issues, with a private security provider who's male. So there's just some really basic things that that need to be thought through. If we're suddenly going to be asking private security guards to step into this medicalized space, well, who are they? What is their background? What is their training? Do they know how to ask the right questions? And so something as simple as, okay, if you're going to be using private security, then maybe you need to think about using more women as your private security personnel. And that's quite a big shift for the industry. But we've seen it in other contexts, where private security providers do have female personnel. It's better all round. It's better for the communities. They're better relations. And some private security providers will explicitly and specifically hire women, to be able to deal with searches or that sort of thing, because they want, especially if they're operating in a country where there might be cultural sensitivities around it. But I think just as a general rule, they need to be aware that there are different impacts on women, and I think that's just that one small example, I think, illustrates. I mean, I could go on in much more detail, but you can go and read the report. You don't need
to. Yeah, no, and we definitely will. I encourage all of our listeners to do that. So thank you, Sophie. I think you've given us a lot of things to think about, but maybe just as sort of a wrap up to this conversation, you said that there are a lot of things that need to be thought through, but who needs to be doing this thinking, and like, where is the change going to come from?
I can say very easily, states. There's a real danger here that states have sort of dropped the ball, as it were, when it comes to private security. There's a danger that because we have an international regulatory system, that's the end of the story. But I've highlighted some of the limitations of the international regulatory system. And it we can't let states off the hook. International law should never let states off the hook, whether it's international hard law or soft law. And I mean, international law really only represents, I often say to my students, it only represents the lowest common denominator. It's the minimum standards that you could get everyone to agree to. They're not aspirational. And I think that's really important to remember. When we're talking about COVID-19, I think we've got to make sure that states regulate this sector. That's the bottom line. They need to regulate it. They need to regulate who the personnel are. What's the vetting? What's the training? Is it continuous doing? Ongoing training of them, especially in relation to human rights. That's really really significant, and holding them to account when something goes wrong in the legal system. But I think in COVID-19 times, we've got to really be alert to the dangers that emergency legislation poses. That the emergency legislation that states are utilizing to combat this public health emergency. And particularly around the outsourcing. So we don't necessarily know who's being awarded a contract to provide security. They haven't necessarily gone through the usual checks and balances that surround public procurement. We've got to be really alert to the fact that there's a potential for abuse and misuse there. And as I said, particularly in relation to marginalized groups. And as I said earlier, you know, this emergency legislation cannot be allowed to just solidify and to become concretized so that it suddenly it's gone from being emergency legislation to normality, to day-to-day legislation. And because it will ingrain human rights violations. And, you know, of course, you know, we absolutely don't want that. And as I say in a recent paper, you know, states don't escape their human rights obligations when they choose to outsource security to the private sector, even in a public global pandemic.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sokka McLeod. I think that's a great point to end on, that states cannot outsource their human rights obligations, and it is something that continues whatever the situation. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this topic of private security, human rights, and COVID-19, and some of your suggestions for the future regulation of this area, which, as we now know, is extremely important. Thank you very much for your time, and it was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Jess. It's my pleasure too.